Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when you're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you're sitting by your iPod, iPad, or any device and hitting play. Today we have an interesting and annual show on the top 10 e-discovery cases of 2012. This is the fourth time we've done this show with my good friend Ron Hedges, former magistrate judge from New Jersey and an e-discovery consultant, speaker, and special master. Ron is now our most frequent guest on ESI Bytes, having just tied Judge Grimm. Ron, this is short-lived, though. Judge Grimm is going to be doing a show with us in January on collections. He will retake the lead. And while mentioning it, I want to give a quick congratulations to Judge Grimm. As he went silent while he was waiting to be see if he was going to get appointed as a federal district judge in Maryland, and he has done that, and well-deserved. So looking forward to doing some more shows with Judge Grimm.
Well, sick old on this. What can I tell you?
Yep. So, Ron, you'll be doing more shows too, okay? So this will be an ongoing battle. Ron served as United States Magistrate Judge in the District of New Jersey from 1986 to 2007. He's a member of the Sedona Conference Advisory Board, participates in Sedona Working Groups on e-discovery and records, international e-discovery, confidentiality, public access. He's a member of the advisory boards of the Advanced E-Discovery and Corporate Counsel Institutes of Georgetown University Law Center, where he teaches e-discovery and evidence as an adjunct faculty member. He's published a number of books on e-discovery, and a very visible speaker and analyst in the area. So, Ron, let's start the show. First of all, is it getting harder and easier to find cases to put on this list since we started back in 2009 doing this show?
You know, it's interesting. I was speaking to someone a few days ago, and I talked about how mature this field is. And if you stop and think that the Zubelake decisions and Morgan Stanley decision out of Florida state courts came about 10 years ago, if that. No, I don't think it's hard at all. It's a very developing field. It's developing because we're not seeing any new rules or legislation really on point. And I don't know that we will, at least for a year or two. And we have new technologies emerging all the time. And whenever there's a new technology, we've got to fit it into the common law. So, no, I don't think it's harder at all. I just think things change. And a perfect example of that, of course, is something we're going to be talking about. A year ago, who would have thought predictive coding was where it was going to be this year, frankly?
Yes, we'll be. Of course, I'll be joining you in those discussions and contributing a little bit more than just questions, since I was involved in some of them, and I have a lot of opinions on predictive coding. But so let's start on some cases here. These aren't in any particular order of importance, but in deference to the Supreme Court, let's start with the United States versus Jones. We're going to count this as two cases because of the remand of the district court. And the most recent cite is criminal action number 05-0386 from December 14, 2012. We initially covered this case on ESI Bytes back in January. We knew it was an important case, but now it's been addressed on remand. And in this case, the Supreme Court tackled GPS searches and search warrant requirements. And Ron, what are your thoughts on why this case is important?
Well, let's back up to the Supreme Court opinion first. The Supreme Court opinion, through three separate opinions, or opinions of the justices, brought out, for the first time in the criminal law at the Supreme Court level, the question of ESI in criminal cases. There was an earlier Supreme Court decision called City of Ontario versus Kwan that addressed reasonable expectations of privacy, but it did it in the context of a public employer and an employee. When the Supreme Court had an opportunity to look at Jones, it divided. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the facts, a GPS transmitter had been surreptitiously put on a vehicle, and the driver, who was a suspected drug dealer or involved in the drug trade, was tracked for about 30 days. And the case goes up to the Supreme Court. Justice Scalia, writing for several other justices, analogized what was going on to 17th or 18th century concepts of trespass, that if I do something to interfere, Carl, with your enjoyment of property, I'm trespassing. So the Scalia group effectively avoided the entire question of reasonable expectations of privacy and, let's say, emerging concepts of the Fourth Amendment and said this is a trespass, it's unconstitutional, something's wrong. Justice Scalia wrote for another group of justices who really went off on the reasonable expectations idea, saying that, you know, 30 days is too long. Maybe looking at where you are at one point is okay, law enforcement, but to track someone for that period of time, you're really interfering or compromising the privacy of that person or his or her expectations that they can travel without being looked at without a warrant. And Justice Sotomayor concurred in the overall decision, which was there was a problem here, but also said maybe it's time to reinvent the wheel of reasonable expectations of privacy. We need to think about it again in the electronic era. The case goes back on remand to the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. Carl, you just gave the citation to it. It's 10 days old today.
Yep.
And reading that decision is an interesting little review of how the courts are divided about reasonable expectations of privacy in the Fourth Amendment sense. The Fourth Amendment, if for those of you who are listening who are familiar with criminal law, has both an objective and subjective component of reasonable expectations of privacy, just as we really have in the civil side. But we've got this constitutional overlay. And I think it's fair to say there's no uniformity of opinion across the federal courts, either at the circuit or the district court level. And the court said, you know, these are all interesting things. We need to address these someday. But right now, there is an exception to the warrant requirement, and that exception is good faith reliance by police officers on existing law, basically. And the court said, you know, back when this GPS transmitter was attached, and even today, there's no consensus across the federal courts. We don't have any guidance from the Supreme Court, really, as to what's going on. And officers, you had a good faith reliance on existing law. That is an exception to the warrant requirement, and the district court refused to suppress the evidence that was going to come in on a remand trial that tracked this defendant for 30-odd days or so. And there are a lot of other nuances, Carl. There was a question of relying on an expired warrant, and one warrant was issued in D.C. and one was issued in Maryland and the like. But I think the takeaway from these decisions are, number one, and there's no question about this, we are seeing an explosion of law involving the criminal side of ESI. And number two, the courts are divided as to expectations of privacy. And number three, when we started, and I talked about how young a field this is, in many ways the criminal field is a lot younger than the civil field in the area. And we're going to see a lot of discussion on this in the coming year. I expect this decision that was just coming out of D.C. after trial, assuming there's a conviction, unless there's some type of interlocutory appeal, will go up to the D.C. Circuit and maybe wind its way back to the Supreme Court again. There's a lot going on in this area.
Yeah, this is one of those situations where, you know, if you eliminated the word judge and you wrote parent, parents' understanding of privacy rights with all these new tools is all over the place. And this is one area where I wish we had a panel of parents deciding these types of issues, because the technology is changing so quickly. And, you know, kids seem to be the ones that experiment with a lot of this technology. So I think we're on the firing line to some extent.
You know, you raise another interesting issue. There's a lot going on now in this entire area, and I guess we can talk about that at social media later on, of what are expectations of privacy, what are objective and subjective expectations of privacy, how private does private have to be to mean anything, which is always an interesting issue. And the public sphere, when can a school district, for example, do something to discipline a student for cyberbullying, for lack of a better phrase, or something along those lines? So there's just so much going on here now, Carl.
So you answered the first question again. It's very easy to find cases. So let's go to another case here, and this was a case that caught my eye when you talked about it. IMO disciplinary proceeding against McGrath, 174 Washington 2nd, 813 Supreme Court 2012 in Bank. Anytime attorneys are caught in the net of e-discovery cases, a top 10 case naturally emerges. So, Ron, why don't you fill us in on this case and why it's important?
Why did I pick this one? I picked this one because I think we're going back to the idea of competence, and we're also going back to attorneys' obligations under 26G, not of the federal rules, obviously, but of state rules. And the question becomes, when you're dealing with e-discovery, what can an attorney certify to when he or she is either making a discovery request or responding to a discovery request? And what happens when the lawyer doesn't get it right? And, you know, talking about this, Carl, I think I still have to go back to the Taylor decision from the Third Circuit that I believe we talked about.
We did that, yeah, last year.
And we're in the entire area, but with this, and that's the overlay of the model rules of professional conduct and what happens then and the like. And what's interesting in that is the rules were amended in August, and I don't know how many people realize this, to address electronic discovery, among other things. And we've seen the ABA now come out and talk about competence in the area of electronic discovery, talk about obligations when attorneys send information that they shouldn't be sending, or when attorneys receive information that they know or they reasonably should know contain privileged information. So we're seeing another big area where we're having a lot of things advance very quickly. And one of the big areas in this, I'm going back to social media again, Carl, because it's such a focus.
Mm-hmm.
What can an attorney do and not do to investigate people, to contact people, and the like? There's just so much stuff going on here these days that we need to think about and talk about.
Yeah, you know, before you go into the facts of the case, I just want to mention in the networking group that I participate in Pittsburgh, our Friends of eDiscovery chapter, one of the judges that works with this on this group with me, Judge Conte, specifically wanted to have one whole meeting on 26G and try to have a discussion among our local bar of eDiscovery lawyers about what it really means to certify and if people are missing the point of the plain meaning of what a certification means. You know,
well,
what steps have you taken? Is it reasonable?
I think that's probably a good focus for this disciplinary opinion. And I'm going to broaden it a little bit beyond the facts and to talk about how should an attorney know what should go into a certification or not. And that goes back to Taylor, and it goes back to these amended rules that just came out in August. And Rule 1.1 requires competence of a lawyer, and what the Taylor opinion says and what the ABA says is, look, you're dealing with electronic information now. You either have to learn about it yourself so you can make representations, and if you don't, you need to be able to go to someone out there who you consult with, perhaps an expert or someone else, to get some idea as what's going on so you put it in a certification. And I think there are a lot of ways to do that, Carl. I think an attorney can learn about it, although some of the things we're talking about and learning about in the world of ESI, I think it's going to be pretty hard for an attorney to really wrap himself or herself around all that. I think we're getting to the point where expert either in fact or in word, we need to have someone helping us along in this area. And I think one of the problems we had in this Washington opinion is the attorney just was certifying and doing things he shouldn't have done. Pretty simple and straightforward to me in a lot of this. And I don't know what the simple solution to it is, and I don't know if there is a simple solution, to be very honest with you. I doubt there is.
Yeah, I've seen this at CLEs I teach at when you start talking about technology. I remember being up at a meeting in Cleveland last year, and the audience, all lawyers, said, we're trying to keep the cases cost down, so we're doing everything we can not to bring in another expert with technology. And, you know, I sort of looked dumbfounded and said, do you understand technology? Then how can you keep the cost down by getting into the space unless you really have a decent grasp of it for many cases?
And I think we're going to hear about that too, because when you talk with me about predictive encoding and the like, I suppose.
Oh yeah.
I'm not iconoclastic about it. I understand it's necessary, and I understand we have to do it at some point. But in a sense, it's counterintuitive, because you're loading costs up front with the idea that you're saving costs later on. And I think it's fair to say a lot of lawyers would think to themselves, maybe that's not the way to go. Maybe we need to think of another way to do this, because something may happen along the way and we can save costs. So
we may get into this in Pippin, but anyway.
Anyway, so
so back to this case.
Well, that's basically my take on the Washington opinion, that a court was not happy with the way a lawyer was comporting himself in the world of ESI. Certifications were questionable and the like, and I think it just, you recognize lawyers can get dinged for things like this.
Okay, fair warning. Let's go to the next case. Insulation Plastics, Inc. v. Medex Cardiopulmonary, Inc., Civil Action 207-CV-116 out of the Southern District of Ohio from August 28, 2012. So, Ron, what does this case teach us about waiving privilege? And I'm presuming, how does this tie into Rule 502D?
Well, it doesn't tie into Rule 502D at all, because 502D is not invoked in it to protect people. But here's an example, a perfect example of, I think, a disconnect between someone who's doing something and something that gets done. And I don't know what the problem was, other than that there were productions made. The productions included privileged material. Back when the production was first being, even before it was being made, a consultant or vendor had been hired. The vendor had gone through various reviews to try to pull out privileged information. And you tell me, Carl, you're the technologist. Something went wrong here in the middle. So either a final privilege review was not done, more likely there was some technical glitch that scrubbed out all the redactions or all the withholding of information. And a court looked at Rule 502B and said, you know, you have to take reasonable steps to avoid privilege waiver. You're doing automated reviews, and the court didn't say that, but I think it's fair to say, you know, it's laudatory to do automated reviews. We realize you have to do it, but you have to take reasonable steps, and something went wrong here. We know that there was a review done. We know that there were attempts made to cull out privileged information or information subject to work product. And we know when the information went out, that information was disclosed. So I don't know. You tell me, Carl, what wasn't done that should have been done here, other than maybe an eyeball review by somebody, at least a spot check, before this large amount of information went out? And I should also say, as you're reading it, this court has a very low tolerance for mistakes. I know there were not that many documents. There were, I believe, 5,000 or so documents going out, and a certain percentage of those were privileged and should not have gone out. So one of the things that the court looked at was to say, you know what, there was a big inadvertent production here. And that's something we're going to take into account against the producing party when we decide what was reasonable or not.
So there are so many moving parts. Yeah, there are so many moving parts that, you know, technology can go wrong. Someone can hit the wrong button. That in this area, if you're not availing yourself of Rule 502D and protecting yourself from inadvertent production, you know, I've seen judges on panels say that they think that this might almost be malpractice, because then you have to really show that all the steps that you took that were reasonable to try to claim some type of a defense, whereas you can just put it in an order that, hey, this is complicated, something might get through. Oftentimes they do. We have a, you know, oftentimes a lot of data that we're working with, and this just is one of the steps. And then, you know, one other aspect I always like to add when talking about 502D, and this again came out of our Friends of eDiscovery group, one of the judges in Pittsburgh said, hey, I've seen 62 orders this year in my first 4 months on the bench, and only three or four of them had 502E orders attached to them. You can't just take advantage of 502D without putting what you want to have happen in an order. So our court has actually worked to create a model order to try to get around that problem.
Well, I have to tell you, I think 502D has failed. And I don't think it's a failure in the rule. I think it's just an indication that the corporate community, and that's who I'm really going to focus on here, because let's generalize and say corporations and government agencies are going to be the ones that have the large amounts of data.
Yep.
They're the ones that need to enter into 502E agreements or 502D orders, assuming a judge finds good cause to sign one. And my sense is, talking to a lot of people, they have conversations with their clients, and their clients say, look, I don't care. The fact of the matter is, if I do a quick peek with someone, and for those of you who are listening aren't familiar with that, a quick peek just would be, if Carl and I are adversaries, I go to Carl and say, Carl, here's my document set. You haven't served me with a formal request, or I haven't responded to it yet. Take a look at this. And you could take a look at it so we could talk about what's relevant. You could take a look at it to fine-tune your requests or whatever. But if there's anything privileged in there, you don't get it. I'm going to call it out at some point. The concern I think that people have, and I think it's a legitimate concern, is, you know what, if there's something in there that's privileged and it's important to me, and I let you look at it, Carl, and we've got an agreement, I can't disqualify you. I mean, you've got the knowledge in your head even if you don't get the document. And I think that's the failure of 502D. And my sense is, frankly, going around talking about privilege and waiver and the like, when I go to poll audiences, the knowledge of 502 decreases. To the point now where I even saw a decision out of my old district where there was a question of inadvertent production and waiver, and 502 was not cited in the opinion. So I would kind of tell you that I know one judge, we're going to talk about him later on, has said publicly now the failure to get a 502D order is malpractice. I think the malpractice would be failure to have a conversation with your client about it so your client can give its informed consent as to what you do or not do. But I don't think 502D is a panacea. I appreciate the concern people have. My concern about 502 is that I don't know that the lawyers are that familiar with it anymore, and frankly, I don't know that there are those conversations going on in high-volume cases that I think, as a matter of competence, should be happening.
Yeah, I view it as it's getting a free it's almost like a Wheel of Fortune getting a free spin. You know,
exactly.
I mean,
yep.
Why not take advantage of it? Just like our discussion on how privacy issues are changing and eroding over time with new technology, the fact of the matter is there's so much data that we have to get through that we're throwing nets at the data.
Yeah.
And the privileged stuff's going to get out in most cases. Now, it may be a very small volume. You may do everything you can to stop it. But you know, the fact is it's an overwhelming amount of data. We're throwing technology at technology. In ways that, you know, the original technology wasn't designed to do. We have people interfacing, and there's a lot of volume.
And the other problem, the other realistic problem, I think, Carl, is that there are vendors and there are vendors. And I wouldn't want to be in a situation where my client chose a vendor or I chose a vendor because they sounded good, and my case becoming the beta site for what a vendor does. Or doesn't. So that's another entirely different issue, and I don't have an answer to that because we don't rate vendors. We just hear horror stories and probably say, oh, my God, I would never use that person again. But then you don't know whether it's their fault or the fault of a processor or the fault of the attorney or, you know, there's just a lot going on in this area.
Let's go to the next case. jump into some social media cases. Johnson versus Gals, 2012 New York Slip Opinion 03492, Supreme Court Appellate Division, May 3rd, 2012. And, you know, we've talked a bit about the social media area, and even I would acknowledge this is more important than predictive coding cases because it impacts so many cases. So why do we care about this case?
Well, we care about it because here we have a plaintiff in a personal injury action who's allegedly suffered severe injuries, and lo and behold, you go onto her social media page and it doesn't look like she suffered serious injuries. And then the question is, was it error to admit it into evidence? The appellate division says no. It was, the information was not secured surreptitiously or by deceit. And I think we have to realize that social media may start to become the equalizer. We've talked for years about asymmetric litigation. That's where you've got a plaintiff who has little or no information and then secures a mountain load of information from the defendant. The defendant presumably needing to make some type of decision as to whether it's worth litigating or not. And some of the talk now is, you know, everybody's got so – well, not everybody. I don't have a social media page. But everybody or most people in this country are on social media. I recall the statistic, there's a billion people in the world who are on Facebook now. There are multitudes of settings of privacy and privacy, whatever, in various social media sites. And the question is, if you decide to post things to friends and you have 2,000 friends and your friends can send things to friends and this and that and whatever, and by the way, you don't own the information because we know, for example, Facebook says it does. How do you protect anything as private? There are statutes that theoretically limit discovery. But we know that really doesn't work because what can happen, it's happened in a couple decisions already. I am your adversary. Your client has things on social media. As a general proposition, there's a statute called the Stored Communications Act, which, depending on certain things, provides that a social media provider does not need to give content to me and should not give me content. But I could go to the judge and say, hey, make Carl's client friend me so I can look at it, or make Carl's attorney become a friend so you can review it and decide what's discoverable. Or judge, you know, have them friend. This, a judge actually suggested this. The judge said, make me a friend. I will do it in camera and decide what can be turned over or not. So there's a lot of ways to get this information. I think we need to realize that social media, ESI, is as discoverable as anything else is. We may need to take a couple extra steps to get it. But I think the point of this Johnson case, it can be the game winner or loser. And people don't think, I think, about what they often put on social media, because it's kind of like the contemporaneous outburst. Gee, I was skiing.
Yeah.
Look how good I am, or I was dancing on the top of a bar, or whatever I did. And they're in litigation. It comes back to bite them.
Yep, it's the O.J. glove situation. I mean, people don't push. Everyone has a more exciting life online than they in reality. The mundane doesn't get on social media.
Well, you know, I don't know.
It can be dangerous.
I think there are people who could use social media as a great way to communicate and the like. But I think the main problem with social media, very honestly, is that we really are not sure about expectations of privacy on it. There's a lot of theoretical discussions going on about expanding the concept of privacy to include social media. But frankly, you know, if you and I are having a conversation and I send a copy to a friend because I want the friend to see how great the conversation was, I don't think I have any expectation of privacy left in that communication because I've let someone else see it.
I agree.
You know, this, I think there's going to be big debates about this as we go forward. But, you know.
Well, we have one on the other, in a case on the other end of the curve on social media. Mailhout v. Home Depot USA Inc., number CV 11-03892, DOC SSX Central District, California, September 7th, 2012. This is a case where social media didn't get in. So what did Mailhot teach us about this topic?
Well, Mailhot brought us back into the federal rules themselves, which talk about, not to be precise about discovery, but basically saying, you know, you can't ask for the kitchen sink. We have proportionality principles under 26B2C. The rules require you to do more than just ask for everything under the sun. And Mailhot, to me, is interesting, and I put it on my top list for the year because it recognizes there are limits to what you get. And just because there's social media doesn't mean you get everything. And I think there are a couple decisions coming out now where courts, I think, are looking at potential volumes of ESI and recognizing that we need to control, we the court, if the parties can't do this, need to control the scope of the request. We need parties to be precise as to what they want. Not precise. Precise is a wrong word because the rules don't require that. But we need something beyond asking for everything. And I think 26B2C is the proportionality rule, and that's the way to go about doing that. And if not that, going back to the basic concepts under Rule 33 and 34, that's the interrogatory rule and the document request rule, as to how you ask for things. It was bound to happen, Carl. You know, we allow the discovery. Sooner or later, someone's going to ask for a lot, and a court's going to say no. There are limits to what you get or not get in litigation.
And what a great setup for Pippins v. KPMG.
Well.
To, you know, 2012 Westlaw 370321 Southern District, New York, February 3rd, 2012. I mean, this case garnered a lot of press this year. What do you think is important about this case? And given your previous discussion about reining in discovery costs or proportionate response, you know, how do we distinguish this case if you want to rein upfront discovery costs?
Well, let's start off by saying this is not a discovery case. This is a preservation case.
Mm-hmm.
And the question not is what's discoverable, really. The question is what does KPMG need to preserve in a class action or a collective action that's really just getting started. And if you go to see the magistrate judge's opinion, which is not the one you cite, the first magistrate judge's opinion really got a lot of people's steam up because it said, you know, there's really no, I think you could say, there's really no rule for proportionality in preservation.
Mm-hmm.
That caused a firestorm in the community. And then it goes up to the district judge, and the district judge says, well, of course there's room for proportionality. By the way, the magistrate judge didn't mean there wasn't. But remember, we measure proportionality and preservation by Rule 26B1 of the federal rules, and you have to preserve more than what's relevant. You have to preserve what's relevant plus stuff that could lead to admissible evidence later on. So we start our preservation regime from the concept of discovery being very broad in the United States. And we also lead to an argument being advanced now, and Carl, I'm sure you've heard this, if you didn't articulate it or agree with it, that companies over-preserve, government agencies over-preserve. And my general answer to that is, you know, let's step back here. If you're a company or you're an agency, you preserve things for litigation purposes, but you also retain them for other reasons. Maybe there are statutes or regulations that require you to keep things. Maybe you keep a lot of stuff for business reasons. And whenever I hear about over-preservation, I always take it with kind of a grain of salt because I've never really been able to sit down with the records person or whatever and get a handle on how much stuff they would be keeping anyway. So that's my grain of salt about that. But the point is that the initial preservation decision or the preservation decision you make after you argue with your adversary is going to be broader than what you produce, most likely, because the adversary may be focusing on certain things. And by the way, what you preserve and what you produce is a gigantic amount of information compared to whatever goes into a motion or a trial because we know they're limited. So I think we're looking at a funnel, and we need to think about funnels.
I'm sitting with the Microsoft letter open in front of me with their funnel chart on 48 million pages preserved in their average case down to 141,000 documents actually pages produced out of that 48 million and then 142 pages used. It's a big funnel.
Well, maybe they made the wrong preservation decision in the first place.
You see, I think I don't have a problem with preserving broadly, but you know, when I look at Pippin's VKPMG, I look at the inability to work with the other side to try to fashion why something's burdensome and here's some information, and why don't we look at this together and try to come up with something intelligent?
Well, let me suggest something to you about what you just said. I'm not aware that burdensomeness is a reason not to preserve. It's a reason not to produce. So I think if an organization has ASI, or paper for that matter, whatever, that falls within the confines of a claim or defense or that could lead to evidence, it's got to be preserved. Go back to the Judicial Conference of the United States, change the scope of discovery in the United States, or corporation or government agency start having a records retention policy that enables a lot more things to be done. I hear you. I think it's a self-inflicted wound.
I think that you can have your cake and eat it too in this area, though, because I think, even if you preserve broadly, that doesn't mean that you have to go further and process everything. You intelligently do your best to hold aside, and in this case, I mean, you've got a list of employees and past employees that might be impacted.
And you know
but,
what?
You know.
Also, it leads to so many other questions, Carl, because, you know, Judge Shenlin, I think it's fair to say in her opinions, does not look well on self-collection. We also know there are questions about how you go out and even suggest you do litigation holds. How wide does the hold notice have to be? Can you do an oral notice? Does it have to be written? There's just a lot of stuff that's out there in the concept of preservation I think we need to talk about, and maybe 2013 will be the year to talk about that.
This will lead us into predictive coding, but the area that I'm looking at in predictive coding is the ability to train a predictive coding tool or any search tool does better when a collection is rich, meaning there's more responsive information than not more than, but you're dealing with, 10% responsive or 5%, which means you're aiming where you see fire, not where you think there might be some smoke, okay, in terms of where you're aiming your search methodology. And, you know, with these tools, you can actually produce a heck of a lot quicker and do something iterative by training on data that, you know, that you think there's most likely going to be responsive information there and work your way outward. But I think you can have your cake and eat it too if you preserve broadly and you work your way into data if you need to. But there's a carrot and a stick there.
Well, the other
if you have tools, you can produce a heck of a lot quicker and give people at least a taste of some of the evidence quicker if you could figure this out quicker using the tools.
There are so many things going on in this concept of preservation and predictive coding and the like, and what organizations do with data or can do with data. There was a survey that just came out that said, if I recall, at least 20% of social media organizations or companies, whatever, reserve to themselves the right to sell your information. So, you know, we know there's money in ESI, there's money in social media and the like, and I guess we need to throw that into a calculus. But that's neither here nor there, so I think we need to go back to preservation.
The calculus is where I think the lawyers have the most problems. Is you know, lawyers tend to say, oh, this is burdensome, or this, but you know, by actually doing a little bit of sampling and digging and throwing some numbers down to support the argument is you know, one of the ways I think technology and law can fit together a little bit better. But now I'm chomping at the bit. I see the next case here, Ron. It's a predictive coding case.
There are.
So let's go down. I know you're a big fan. So So, of course, everyone starts in the field with De Silva Morvey publicist group from the Southern District of New York, where Judge Peck had two parties come in front of him who appeared interested in using predictive coding. And this has been a topic, of course, Judge Peck has spoken and written about at length. He's been on the show here. One would think things would move smoothly forward. However, that isn't what happened. So, Ron, what's important to you about this case?
Well, there are a couple important things to me about all these cases. Number one, we're beginning to see the courts grapple with protocols. And Judge Peck, for example, had a couple protocols that came out in De Silva Moore. So we're kind of groping our way towards something. Number two, out of all these decisions, Carl, we don't know what's happened. We haven't seen results that had to go back to a court. So we don't know the amount of precision, or we don't know the amount of stability when you've decided that the computer gets it right enough. We don't know how right it has to get. We haven't seen a court review anything. We haven't seen testimony come in as to what was done or not done by courts. So I hate to say we're kind of in the wild, wild west. But we're in the wild, wild west, and for those of you listening who went to the Georgetown Advanced eDiscovery Institute in November, we had a full range of panels on predictive coding, talking about how to do it, where to go with it, and the like. And I think we're going to see more in 2013, Carl. So we're kind of starting. We're seeing the fact that courts accept it. I don't recall we have this on the list, but there was a Delaware Chancery judge who basically went to the parties and said, I like this predictive coding stuff. You guys are going to use it, whether you want to or not. And by the way, if you don't want to, come back and show me good cause why I shouldn't require you to do it. Now, I have my opinions about what that judge did that we don't need to share.
Yep.
But
that's known in the circles as the Hooters case. I don't have the site in front of me, but I probably should have put it on the list. If we group all these cases, you know, we've got Clean Products, which is on the list from the U.S. District Court, Northern District of Illinois, and then Global Aerospace from Loudoun County Circuit Court in Virginia.
And we have Actos from
Louisiana. And Actos is out there, too.
I mean, we have Actos now as a perfect example of the upfront expense. And we're talking about a court approving or a court agreeing with protocols or establish them. Each side gets to have at least three experts who are going to sit down together and reason out how you're going to go about doing the search that's going to be done. Part of the deal from the opinion is, you know, they're looking at a limited number of custodians. This is a national class action, an MDL. There's going to be a lot of data, obviously.
Pharmaceutical case.
Right, and the courts are saying, the judge and the parties are saying, look, let's start small, which is, I think, what you have to do with everything. Let's start small. Let's see what we've got. You guys sit down, come up with the protocols you want to use, come up with the stability you want. We talked about before, and I'm sure you can talk about much better than I can, and then talk about how correct the answer should be. What percentage of relevant information do you want to shoot out? But that raises all other issues, Carl. It raises issues of work product. I know at least one lawyer in this field who is very well known who will not share the non-responsive seat set. She thinks it's an invasion of work product. There's a lot of things going on. How transparent do you have to be? Should it always be the parties sitting down together and working in Actos? Do you share your entire seat set with the other side? Or do you do what discovery has always been? You do your own, you come up with your predictive coding or your computer-assisted review mechanism. You run it against your data set. You give the results to the other side and say, here's my discovery. This is what I've always done. And go to it. And then the question, I think, at that point, and we're going to see that. I'm sure we're going to see that this year, Carl.
Yeah, I think at some point someone will just say, it's my approach, this is what I'm going to do. And to some extent, that's what we did in Global Aerospace.
Yeah.
But
someone is going to say someday, I think it's you've hidden things or you haven't gotten things. And I expect courts are going to say in this area, you know what, it's not enough to speculate. You got to do something. Now, I don't know how you avoid speculation if a lawyer just thinks something's done wrong. I suppose have access to the same data set or part of the data set, or as has happened in several decisions now, the inadvertently produced document is shown to a witness at a deposition and say, "Judge, I have evidence that something was missed." And the perfect example of this actually goes back to Zubelik, where Laura Zubelik made photocopies of some email that the defendant had not produced in discovery, and she had the so-called smoking gun. So
yeah, I
don't know where we're going to go with all this. We're really at the beginning of it.
I when I look at these cases, I when you start with De Silva and you work your way down, I see to some extent, I coined the term Frankenstein protocols. Well-intentioned people putting body parts together out of fear that something might go wrong in building processes that if you'd started by looking at the process you ended up with, you'd say, we don't want to do that. But under the glare of public scrutiny, you know, people tend to be very nervous about thinking, and they want to be overly cautious. And the result is generally not positive,
well, let's
super positive.
About, yeah, well, let's think about what happened. We had De Silva Moore. De Silva Moore had an overlay of recusal motions and the like in it. De Silva Moore, all De Silva Moore really did was say, okay, guys, go ahead and use it. That's kind of what it said.
Yep.
And then we had the Virginia case, and that case has gone away. And the only thing we really had from a judge in that case is basically the same thing as Andy Peck did, except there were no protocols in an opinion. The judge just hand-wrote on a submission, kind of go ahead and do it, come back and see me when you're done. Clean Products.
Yeah.
Clean Products wasn't even a decision. Clean Products is a transcript of 2 days of a hearing that ran about 800 pages. That went away. Actos, we know the parties are sitting down and doing something with a limited data set. We don't know what they're doing. We haven't seen results. So, you know, I go back to what I said before. We're kind of in the wild, wild west here, and we'll have to see how things go.
The best thing I can say about these cases right now is one thing they have put a lot of focus on is what are we missing? And that is a discussion that we never really got into with traditional ESI and keyword searching. And although there were plenty of academic studies that said, hey, we're missing a lot, both responsive and we're looking at a lot that is not even related to the case. These are flawed search approaches. So that argument that advocates that want to use predictive coding actually can be used in more traditional approaches. And I think that will spur technology adoption quicker than anything when people see how expensive it is to try to get it right using traditional search methods when you're measuring what you didn't produce and finding, oh my God, we have responsive data here that we didn't produce.
Well,
the other thing I wanted to say is that the global aerospace case didn't go completely away. It's the database has now been pulled down, but the objectives that were thrown out, and I worked in this case of hitting a benchmark, were hit, and a validation protocol was submitted to the court. The other side accepted the data, and the court allowed the database to be taken down, all within the timeframes that were suggested. So not all the cases have been train wrecks. Some of them have actually gotten ahead and done what you know the party that wanted to use predictive coding wanted to do. And I would suggest people go online and look for that validation letter that was sent in and filed with the court and the protocol that was put in place and how the sampling was done.
And Carl, if you would send me the validation letter and the court signing off on it, whatever, that would be nice to have in my pile.
I'll send that to you. It's just happened within the last few weeks, and I expect that with the bad, you got to have the good, and there have been some very good positive results in this area that are starting to come out.
I don't think we've seen any bad in the opinions on predictive coding. I mean, there are four cases: the Silva Moore, Clean Products, your case out of Virginia, and Actos. They're the only ones I know of, unless I'm missing.
People say Clean was a bad, but I think it was a learning experience. If plaintiffs went in and said, I want to use predictive coding in the middle of a process after millions of dollars had already been spent and didn't give a clear picture of what they wanted to do. They just threw out a general proposition, predictive coding's better. Contrast that with global, where we said this is the tool, this is the process, this is what we want to do. It's more specific. It's measurable. So I think the next challenges will be more specific instead of a global, we want to use something, that you know, more likely to be successful with a specific suggestion. I think, you know, your experts that you pointed to, the well-known expert who's against handing over seed sets, I mean, there's so many great issues in this area, and training sets is a very valid concern. But you can train randomly instead of with specific seed sets and get around that because you're not handing over specific work product. You're handing over random documents. I mean, there's lots of nuances. That's why this is an area where I think there's going to be a lot more interaction between experts and lawyers to figure this out. It just cries out for that.
Well, I can guarantee you this just about, that if you go to Legal Tech in New York at the end of January this next year in 2013, every other vendor's booth is going to be talking about predictive coding.
I will throw a shout out. We're going through a mock hearing on that at Legal Tech on January 30th, and we've got one prominent judge and maybe a guest, very prominent second judge showing up, and we're going to go actually through a hearing. And Tom Grix is going to be arguing it. Arianna Tadler will be arguing on the other side with Connor Crowley as her expert. Herb Reutblatt will be Tom's. I'll be moderating, and Judge Francis will be the judge, and one other judge, we have our fingers crossed, maybe showing up. So, but that will be fun. We're going to go through a real argument.
Judge Shinlin is coming to Legal Tech, huh?
I didn't say that.
No, I know that. I was just grasping at straws or something like that.
I have lots of friends. Anyway, well, this has been so much fun, Ron. It always is. There's plenty to talk about when we look back over a year in review, and I wish you and all the listeners a happy holiday. Looking forward to 2013 and doing some more shows with you.
Give Paul Grimm my best and tell him that soon I will be ranked above him on your list of speakers again.
I'm going to tell him that he's taking the lead when I announce the show in mid-January. Anyway, thanks for joining us here, Ron. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows later in the year. And I'd like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of shows. Remember, the show website phonetically, as it sounds out, as Easy Bytes of ESI information. But however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI Bytes you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.
And happy Merry Christmas and whatever to everybody else. So thank you very much, Carl.
Okay, great.
Goodbye.
All right, thanks. Bye.